A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's watching what's happening across Europe right now. Immigration protests escalating, flashpoints getting more volatile, and he's zeroed in on a tactic that's become the default response. You see it at a protest in Kulak. You see it at the El Al check-in counters at Ben Gurion. Visibly armed officers, deliberately positioned where everyone can see them. And his question is basically, is the objective just to look scary? Or is there something more to it than that?
That's a sharper question than it sounds, because it forces you to separate what the tactic is supposed to do from what it actually communicates. And those two things are not always the same.
When you see a Garda armed support unit at an immigration protest, in a country where 97% of police don't carry firearms, are they there to stop something from happening, or to make you feel like something might?
That's the tension Daniel's pointing at. The line between deterrence and intimidation, between operational necessity and theater. And it's being tested in real time, because Ireland's Garda Síochána have been deploying exactly these units at protest flashpoints following a wave of arson attacks on accommodation centers, so it's not hypothetical. The question of whether visible armed presence prevents violence or escalates it, that's not settled.
What I find interesting is that Daniel's framing this across two completely different contexts. You've got the protest policing scenario, which is dynamic, politically charged, unpredictable. And then you've got airport security at Ben Gurion, where the same visual tactic, armed guards, exposed weapons, visible positioning, has been running continuously for decades. Same surface tactic, completely different logic underneath.
That's exactly the right way to frame it. Most people collapse these into one category. They see armed police at an airport and armed police at a protest and think, well, it's the same thing, it's security. But the threat model at Ben Gurion is fixed. Location, single catastrophic event prevention. The protest scenario is fluid. You're managing a crowd whose composition, mood, and objectives can shift in minutes. The same visual signal does different work in those two environments, and confusing them is how you get bad policy.
Where do we start? The theory of what visible deterrence is supposed to do, or what actually happens when you deploy it.
Let's start with the theory, because it's surprisingly clean and it'll make the mess clear faster. Visible deterrence rests on a simple idea from rational choice criminology. If a potential offender sees a police officer, they recalculate. The perceived certainty of getting caught goes up, the expected cost of offending goes up, and the behavior gets suppressed. It's deterrence by communication. You're sending a signal, we are here, we are capable, do not test us.
That works. In the textbook.
It works under specific conditions. The target has to be rational, the signal has to be read correctly, and the cost of compliance has to be lower than the cost of offending. Those conditions are not always met. And that's before we even get to the displacement problem. The fact that deterrence often doesn't eliminate behavior, it just moves it to the unguarded side entrance. Research shows displacement effects in the 30 to 50% range. You post armed officers at one protest site, the protest shifts to a different location. You harden one airport checkpoint, the threat vector moves to the queue outside. Deterrence is spatially specific. It protects the thing you're standing in front of, and not much else.
That's the first crack in the theory. What's the second?
The audience effect, and this is where it gets genuinely tricky. Visible deterrence doesn't just communicate to potential offenders. It communicates to everyone. The public, the media, the protesters who were never going to do anything violent. And the message it sends to them is, the authorities believe something dangerous is about to happen here. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy risk. You show up looking like you expect violence, and you've just raised the ambient tension level for everyone present.
The signal that's supposed to say, stay calm, we've got this, actually says be afraid. We might need these.
That's the paradox, and it's not theoretical. There's a body of research on this in protest policing. When police deploy invisibly aggressive postures, with riot gear and weapons displayed, it can escalate encounters that would otherwise have remained peaceful. Not because the protesters are inherently violent, but because the police posture changes the emotional calculus. It feels like a provocation, and some percentage of people will respond to that provocation.
Which brings us to Ireland, because Ireland makes this paradox particularly sharp. You've got a police force that is overwhelmingly unarmed. It's basically part of the national identity. Community policing. Relationship-based, officers walking beats without firearms, and then suddenly, at specific flashpoints, you've got the armed support unit showing up with visible weapons.
And that contrast is the whole story. In France, if you see gendarmes mobiles with shields and helmets at a protest, that's Tuesday. France has roughly 100,000 officers who deploy with visible crowd control equipment as standard procedure. Nobody thinks something extraordinary is happening. But in Ireland, where only 2-3% of Garda officers carry firearms on duty, the appearance of an armed support unit is a significant escalation signal. It tells everyone watching that the state has assessed this situation as requiring a level of force that normal policing can't handle.
Once you send that signal, you can't unsend it.
You can't. Visible deterrence is a communication tactic. Its success or failure depends entirely on what message is received, not what message was intended. And in the Irish context, the message received might be very different from what the Garda strategist had in mind.
Daniel's question, is it just to look scary? The answer is no, but also yes. It's not just to look scary because there is a genuine deterrence logic underneath it, but the looking scary part is the entire mechanism. If nobody saw the weapons, the deterrence wouldn't work. The visibility is the point.
Which means we have to ask a harder question. If the mechanism is visibility, and visibility carries all these second-order risks, escalation, normalization, legitimacy, erosion, then when is it actually worth it? That's where the airport comparison Daniel raised becomes really useful, because it shows us a case where the same tactic makes sense, and the contrast tells us why it so often doesn't make sense at protests.
Alright, so that's the setup. Next, I want to walk through the actual mechanisms, what's happening on the ground when these deployments happen, and what the evidence says about when they work and when they backfire.
Let's define the thing properly. Visible deterrence is the deliberate positioning of police assets, and I want to emphasize assets, not just officers, in public view to signal capacity for force. The key word is capacity. You're not necessarily signaling intent to use it. You're signaling that you could.
Which is a distinction that matters. An officer with a holstered sidearm is sending a different message than one with a weapon drawn. The first says, I am prepared. The second says, I am about to act.
Visible deterrence lives in that first category. It's about presence, not action. The theory is that the mere visibility of capability changes behavior without anyone having to do anything. It's deterrence as theater in the most neutral sense, a performance designed to produce a specific response in the audience.
The audience, critically, is not just the person who might throw a brick. It's everyone. The journalist, the resident watching from a window, the politician who demanded the deployment, the voter watching the evening news.
Which is why we have to contrast it with covert deterrence. Covert deterrence works invisibly, plainclothes officers in the crowd, surveillance, intelligence gathering. The deterrent effect is still there, but the mechanism is uncertainty, not visibility. You don't know where the police are, so you behave as if they could be anywhere.
The trade-off is interesting. Covert deterrence avoids the escalation risk and the audience effect. Nobody sees armed officers and thinks something dangerous must be happening. But it also doesn't reassure the public. If you're a resident near a protest site and you don't see any police, you might feel abandoned, even if there are plainclothes officers everywhere.
That's the legitimacy dimension. Visible deterrence is partly a performance for the law-abiding public. It says, we are here, we are handling this, you are safe. Covert deterrence doesn't send that message at all. So police forces are often choosing between two audiences. The potential offender, who might be deterred by either approach, and the general public, who may only feel safe if they can see the police.
Which brings us back to Daniel's core question. Is visible deterrence a communication tactic aimed at potential offenders, or a performance aimed at the general public? Because if it's the first, it's operational policing. If it's the second, it's political theater.
The uncomfortable answer is that it's usually both at the same time, and the proportions shift depending on the context. At Ben-Gurion, the balance tilts heavily toward operational. You're communicating to a specific threat actor about a specific target. At a protest, the public communication function might actually be the dominant one, even if nobody in the chain of command would say so out loud.
The question isn't really, is it theater or is it real? It's who is the intended audience, and what are they supposed to do with the information?
That's it. And once you start asking that question at every deployment, a lot of tactical decisions start looking different. Let's walk through the three mechanisms. Mechanism one is the cleanest, rational deterrence theory. Visible police presence raises the perceived certainty of apprehension. If I'm thinking about throwing a brick, and I see an armed officer 20 meters away, my internal cost-benefit calculator updates. For a rational actor, that should suppress the behavior.
The key word there is rational actor.
It's doing enormous work. Rational deterrence assumes the person you're deterring is making calculated decisions about risk and reward. That holds up reasonably well for premeditated actions, someone planning to set fire to a building. It holds up much less well for someone who's angry, caught up in a crowd dynamic, or acting on impulse. In those cases, the visible officer might not even register until after the action is already taken.
It works best on the person who showed up with a plan, and worst on the person who showed up with a feeling.
That distinction matters enormously for protest policing, because protests contain both types. Visible deterrence is calibrated for the first group and largely irrelevant to the second.
Which brings us to mechanism 2, the displacement problem. When you deter behavior at one location, how much of it actually goes away versus how much just moves?
The research is fairly consistent and is not flattering to the tactic. Studies show that somewhere between 30 and 50% of the deterred behavior simply relocates. You post armed officers at the main entrance to a protest site. The confrontation shifts to the side street. You harden security at one airport checkpoint. The threat modeling shifts to the queue outside or the parking structure.
You haven't eliminated the problem. You've just changed its address.
And in some cases, displacement can make things worse because the new location is less controlled, less visible, harder to respond to. You've pushed the problem out of your carefully prepared defensive position and into an area where you have no infrastructure, no cameras, no backup. There's a reason displacement is the dirty secret of deterrence-based policing. It produces very satisfying before and after photos of the protected location and very unsatisfying outcomes for the people who now have to deal with the problem two blocks away.
All right, mechanism 3. The audience effect. This is the one that keeps me up, because it's the least intuitive and the most dangerous.
It's the one that directly answers Daniel's question about whether the tactic is just about looking scary. The audience effect says that visible deterrence communicates to everyone, not just the potential offender. When the public sees armed officers deployed, the message they receive is, the authorities believe this situation is dangerous enough to require armed officers. That message can escalate tension even if nothing was going to happen in the first place.
Because you've just told everyone present that you expect violence.
You've told them, and you've told the media, and you've told the wider community watching on the news. The deployment itself becomes evidence that the situation is volatile, and once that perception takes hold, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People show up expecting confrontation. Some of them act accordingly. The thing you deployed to prevent, you may have helped create.
The signal that's supposed to say, we are in control, actually says we are worried. And worry is contagious.
Worry is deeply contagious. And this is where the Irish case becomes so instructive, because the baseline matters enormously. In a country where armed police are routine, the audience effect is muted. Nobody reads anything special into it. But Ireland is not that country.
Only 2-3% of Garda officers carry firearms. The force is built on a community policing model, unarmed, relational, officers who know the local shopkeepers by name. That's not just a tactical choice, it's basically a national value.
The Garda Síochána were founded specifically as an unarmed force, and that identity has survived a century. So when the armed support unit shows up at a protest site, and this is what happened in Coolock in 2025, following a series of arson attacks on accommodation centers being used to house asylum seekers, the visual signal is not, police are here. It's the armed police are here. That distinction is everything.
because it tells the community that the normal rules have been suspended.
The state is saying, through its deployment choices, that this situation exceeds what ordinary policing can handle. That's a profound escalation signal, whether intended or not. And the question Daniel's asking, did it prevent violence or provoke it? That's not answerable in the abstract. It depends entirely on how the community read the signal.
In Kulak, there were mixed signals from the start. You had genuine arson attacks, actual violence that needed a response, but you also had a community that was already suspicious of the state's intentions around immigration and housing. Dropping armed units into that context doesn't just deter, it confirms narratives.
Narratives about the state being heavy-handed. Narratives about the state prioritizing the safety of asylum seekers over the concerns of local residents. Whether those narratives are fair or not is almost beside the point. The point is that the visible armed presence feeds them. It becomes visual evidence for a story people already wanted to tell.
Now contrast that with France. The gendarmes mobiles, roughly 100,000 officers who deploy with shields, helmets, batons as standard operating procedure. If you see them at a protest in Paris, nobody thinks the normal rules have been suspended. That is the normal rule.
And the Nahal protests in 2023 are a perfect case study. The gendarmes mobiles were deployed in force, visible, equipped, unmistakably present. In some locations, that presence deterred violence. In others, it became the focal point for it. Protesters weren't just demonstrating against police violence. They were demonstrating against the visible symbol of state force standing right in front of them.
The same tactic produced opposite effects depending on the crowd, the location, the specific grievance.
Which is the fundamental problem with visible deterrence as a one-size-fits-all strategy. Its effects are not intrinsic to the tactic. They're produced by the interaction between the tactic and the context. The same armed officer who calms one crowd inflames another. And predicting which is which requires intelligence work that visible deterrence, by its nature, doesn't do.
Because visible deterrence is a broadcast. It sends the same message to everyone. It doesn't segment the audience.
It's a blunt instrument being used in situations that demand precision. And the bluntness is the point. It's supposed to be simple, clear, unambiguous. But simplicity in a complex environment is not a virtue. It's a liability. Here's where the story gets more uncomfortable. What happens when the exceptional becomes routine? That's the normalization problem, and it's the first knock-on effect that police forces don't talk about enough.
Because once you've deployed the armed support unit to three protests, the fourth one doesn't feel like an escalation anymore. It just feels like what we do now.
And Ireland is the perfect laboratory for watching this happen, precisely because the baseline is so stark. When 97% of your officers are unarmed, the threshold for calling in the armed units is supposed to be high. It's a break glass in emergency option. But every time you break the glass gets a little easier to break next time. The public's expectation shifts. Politicians start asking why the armed units weren't deployed sooner. The exceptional becomes the standard.
The community policing model that Ireland built its entire identity around. The officer who knows your name, who walks the beat, who de-escalates through relationship rather than force. That model starts to erode. Not because anyone decided to abandon it, but because the visible armed presence redefines what policing looks like.
That's the legitimacy cost, and it's the knock-on effect that should keep police strategists up at night. Visible deterrence trades short-term order for long-term trust. It's a loan you take out against community goodwill, and the interest compounds. Communities that start seeing armed police as occupiers rather than protectors become harder to police without force. You've created the very condition you were trying to avoid.
In Ireland, this isn't abstract. The unarmed tradition isn't just a policy choice. It's wrapped up in national identity, in the history of the force, in the relationship between the state and communities that spent centuries under armed occupation by a foreign power. Deploying visible armed units doesn't just change a tactic. It pulls on threads that go back generations.
The post-2020 U.S. protests are the cautionary tale here. Police departments deployed militarized visible deterrence, armored vehicles, riot gear, aggressive postures, and the result was not order. It was an escalation spiral. Communities that already had strained relationships with police saw those relationships shatter. And the long-term cost of that trust deficit is still being paid, in reduced cooperation with investigations, in recruitment crises, in neighborhoods that simply don't call the police anymore.
Which brings us to the airport comparison Daniel raised, because it seems like a counterexample. Ben Gurion has been running visible armed deterrence for decades, and it works. No one looks at the armed guards at the Al-Aud check-in and thinks, this is eroding my trust in the state.
That's because the context is completely different, and the differences tell us everything. At Ben Gurion, you're protecting a fixed location against a specific, well-understood threat. The threat model is, someone tries to bring a bomb onto an aircraft. That's it. It's not a dynamic political situation. It's not a crowd whose mood is shifting. It's a single catastrophic event that the security posture is designed to prevent, and everyone passing through that checkpoint understands and accepts that logic.
Plus, the public at an airport has already consented to the security framework. You took off your shoes at the scanner. You showed your passport 3 times. The armed guard is just one more layer in a system you already bought into. At the protest, nobody consented to be there in the same way. They showed up to exercise a right, not to pass through a security checkpoint.
That's the category error Daniel's question exposes. Applying airport logic to protest policing assumes that a protest is a security problem with a fixed perimeter and a known threat vector. But it's not. It's a political event with a security dimension. The primary purpose of the police presence isn't to prevent a single catastrophic act. Though that's part of it, it's to manage a dynamic situation where the police themselves are often a party to the conflict, not a neutral third party standing outside it.
The armed guard at Ben Gurion is protecting you from a threat you both agree exists. The armed officer at a protest may be seen as the threat.
That perception gap is everything. At the airport, the visible weapon reads as protection. At the protest, the same visible weapon can read as accusation. You are the potential threat. You are the one being deterred. The tactic is identical. The message received is opposite.
What's the practical implication for police forces facing these decisions right now? Because immigration protests aren't going away, and the pressure to do something visible is only going to increase.
The most effective visible deterrence is the kind that's seen, but not felt. Officers who are present, who are equipped, but whose posture says, we are here to facilitate your right to protest, rather than, we are here to suppress you. That's a harder thing to train and deploy than just posting armed units at a perimeter. It requires officers who can hold the tension between being prepared and being approachable. And it requires a command structure that understands the goal is not to look strong. The goal is to keep the peace.
Which is what Irish community policing was supposed to be good at. It maintained order through relationships, not through displays of force. The armed units represent a departure from that tradition, not an extension of it.
That's the strategic choice facing European police forces right now. Do you double down on visible deterrence, more armed units, more displays of capacity, and accept the long-term legitimacy costs? Or do you invest in intelligence-led, community-based approaches that are less visible, less dramatic, less satisfying to politicians who want to look like they're doing something, but potentially more effective at actually preventing violence?
The political incentive pushes toward visibility. A minister can point to armed officers on the news and say, "We responded. You can't photograph an intelligence network. You can't hold a press conference in front of a community relationship."
That's the uncomfortable truth at the bottom of Daniel's question. Visible deterrence is partly a security tactic and partly a political performance. The balance between those two functions determines whether it works or backfires. And right now, the political function is probably overweighted because it's easier to measure. You can count the armed units deployed. You can't count the trust you didn't lose by not deploying them. That's the measurement problem in a nutshell. The thing that's easiest to count is the thing that's least correlated with long-term success. So let's pull out what actually matters here, because Daniel's question has practical answers that go beyond the academic debate.
And the first one is for the people making these deployment decisions. Visible deterrence is a communication tactic, not a security tactic. That's not a semantic distinction. If you treat it as security, as something that mechanically prevents bad outcomes, you'll miss the fact that its entire mechanism is the message it sends, and the message received is not under your control.
That's the part that gets skipped in operational planning. You can intend to send reassurance. The community can receive intimidation. Both things are true simultaneously, and the second one determines whether the tactic worked. If the public reads your armed presence as a threat, the deployment failed, even if no violence occurred, because you've just spent down trust you'll need later.
For journalists and citizens watching this play out, and Daniel's prompt is basically a citizen's question, there's a diagnostic tool here. When you see visibly armed police at a protest, ask two things. One, what specific threats are they deterring? If nobody can name it, you're probably looking at performance, not operational necessity. Two, what message does this send to the community standing here right now? The answers to those two questions tell you whether you're watching policing or theater.
Those questions are portable. They work at a protest in Kulak. They work at a demonstration in Paris. They work at a political rally anywhere. Specific threat, community message. If the first answer is vague and the second answer is uncomfortable, the deployment is probably driven by political incentives rather than security ones.
The third takeaway is the one Daniel baked into his question from the start, the airport lesson. Visible deterrence works at Ben-Gurion because three conditions hold. The threat is specific, the target is fixed, and the public has already consented to the security framework. Protests meet none of those conditions. The threat is diffuse, the location is fluid, and the crowd hasn't consented to being treated as a security risk. Applying airport logic to protest policing isn't just a different tactic, it's a category error.
That's the insight that should reshape how police forces think about this. You can't import a tactic from a fixed location, single-threat, consent-based environment into a dynamic, multi-actor, rights-based environment and expect the same result. The tactic doesn't travel because the logic underneath it doesn't travel. What looks like prudence at the check-in counter looks like provocation at the protest. Same officers, same weapons, same posture. Completely different meaning.
Here's the open question that's going to define the next few years. Immigration protests aren't slowing down. The pressure on police forces to do something visible is only going to increase. And the strategic fork in the road is this. Does visible deterrence become the default? The thing you reach for first because it photographs well and satisfies the political demand for action? Or do we see a return to community-based, intelligence-led approaches that don't make good television but might actually keep the peace?
I think the answer depends on something that's hard to measure and easy to ignore. Whether the public sees armed police as protectors or provocateurs. And that perception isn't fixed. It's shaped by every single deployment. Every time an armed support unit shows up where it didn't used to, the public updates its model of what policing means. The question is, which direction that update goes?
The uncomfortable part is that police forces don't fully control that perception. They control the deployment. They don't control the meaning. The meaning gets made in the crowd, on social media, in the local pub, on the evening news. By the time the operational planners see the result, the perception is already settled.
Which means the real strategic question isn't, does visible deterrence work? It's what kind of relationship between police and public are we building, one deployment at a time? And that's a question that can't be answered with arrest statistics or incident reports. It requires a longer view than most police forces are institutionally capable of taking.
Daniel's prompt landed on this from two angles, the protest and the airport, and the comparison turned out to be more revealing than either one alone. The same tactic, two completely different logics, and confusing them is how you get policy that looks decisive and works badly.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, the Soviet Union's Caspian Sea Fleet measured depth not in meters or fathoms, but in sajen, an archaic Russian unit equal to 7 feet. This meant a depth of 14 sajen was roughly 98 feet, but only if you remembered that a sajen wasn't the same as an imperial fathom, which is 6 feet. Navigators converting on the fly occasionally ran aground.
So the Cold War had a unit conversion problem.
That's one way to put it.
The question Daniel raised isn't going to resolve itself. Every deployment of visible armed police is a small bet on how the public will read the signal, and the cumulative outcome of those bets is going to determine whether European policing models hold their current shape or drift towards something harder. That's worth watching closely.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us your own questions the way Daniel does, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be here.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.